This is Jim Inkster. You are listening to Talk Louisiana. Robin Dow is producing. We're 89 days away from an election, one day away from Robin's birthday, and we're with you. And we've got an interesting show, and later in the hour, we'll catch up with Mark Ballard in Washington. 89 days before the election. Yesterday, we heard from Michael Baychak, who works with Mayor President Sharon Weston Broom and is trying to get her reelected. And today we'll hear from a fascinating gentleman, Johnny Domino, a digital creator with a website, Ghetto Ways, and he is bullish on Edward Ted James and his quest to become the mayor president. But we begin with a fascinating writer, David Robluski. He, in 2008, wrote his first novel, The Story of Edgar Sawtell. It was a New York Times bestseller. Oprah Winfrey chose it for her book club on September 19th of 2008. And Oprah also included the book as one of the few tangible gifts in her recession-themed Thrifty Oprah's Favorite Things that year. The novel's a retelling of William Shakespeare's Hamlet in rural Wisconsin. The title character is a mute boy who, after his father is killed, runs away, but then returns from his usurped home, hoping to prove his suspicions that his uncle murdered his father. Now, the follow-up is Familiaris, and it is getting rave reviews. It is a big novel, and it is also part of Oprah's book club for 2024. Tom Hanks, who was involved in the movie of the story of Edgar Sawtell, says Robluski has set a storytelling bonfire, has set it. Familiaris is an expansive and enlightening a saga as has ever been written. So good morning, David Robluski.
Good morning. Thanks for having me on.
Well, it's nice to talk with you. And you're a man who, shall we say, was involved in conventional journalism, and then you became an accomplished novelist. That's been 16 years now since The Story of Edgar Sawtell, so I suspect this has been quite an odyssey for you, David.
Oh, it has. The original plan was not to take 15 years to between books, but this book turned out to be much bigger than I expected it to be. I had vowed after Edgar to write a book that was half the length of Edgar. So it's just too much work to write a book that big. And instead, I ended up writing a book that was 1.5 times as long, despite my best efforts to keep it short. So, an odyssey is not an unreasonable word to use.
Well, this is spring 1919 in rural Wisconsin, the Northwoods, where the latest Familiaris is captured. Now, tell us about that time and place.
Yeah, this book is essentially the story of Edgar Sawtell's grandfather. And one of the things that I hasten to always say is that the books don't need to be read in any particular order. I think it's perfectly fine to read either one. I'm actually looking forward to talking with folks who've read them in the reverse order of publication. But what's true at that moment in time is that the Great War has just been closed down. People are returning. Soldiers are returning. The culture has is about to enter a very expansive phase, the jazz age, and there's a real sense of possibility of trying new things, doing new things in the air. And it's in that context that the story begins with John, who is happily living in southern Wisconsin with his newlywed wife, getting accidentally involved in a shooting. He's not the instigator and he's not the target, but he happens to be there. And as a result, he finds himself unemployed and unemployable, and asking what should he be doing with his life? And that is the instigating moment in the story that leads these people that the books are going to follow for 40 years. Mm-hmm. It leads them to this abandoned farm in northern Wisconsin.
Your number is 877-217-5757 for David Robluski. And a listener already at talkatalklouisiana.org who knows a bit about your work asks, I know you live in Colorado. How did you become so familiar, and what kind of research was necessary to become such a great captured writer of Wisconsin's North Woods?
Well, I grew up a couple of hundred miles south of where the story set. So I grew up in central Wisconsin, my concept for the story of Edgar Sawtelle originally was to evacuate all the people on the farm where I grew up, use that as a location, as the stage set for retelling the story, like you said at the beginning. Just bring in all new people and have them play out the story, none of which actually happened in real life. I just want to, you know, emphasize that. But I knew I didn't want it to happen in central Wisconsin, mainly because it was just too familiar to me. So I wanted it to be Wisconsin. I wanted it to be slightly unfamiliar. And I started exploring. I just got in my car and spent many trips exploring northern Wisconsin. I found this little town, Mellon, Wisconsin. It's a real place. Got to know people there, got to know the mayor of Mellon. It's a town of 800 or so. Learned just an enormous amount about the history. As it turned out, the mayor, Joe Barabee, was a local historian and had compiled this amazing work of history of Mellon itself that involved, he had recruited the entire town to write this two-volume history taken from articles in the Mellon Weekly Record, which is the local newspaper. And I found that on my first trip there and used it extensively. I would just page through it for whatever year happened to be going on and would read about what was in the local newspaper, you know, on that day. And sometimes it was a small thing. There would be, you know, local rumors, you know, such and such an animal broke into somebody's house. Sometimes it would have to do with large national events. And I really used that extensively as a cue for what to talk about on a day-to-day basis in people's lives.
Well, David Robluski is born in one of the towns with a great name in America, and I think I know how it's pronounced. I've heard it a time or two because there are a lot. This is a small town, but like many, it has a lot of people who have come from Oconomowoc. Is that correct? Oconomowoc, Wisconsin. Did I get it
nicely
close?
Nicely done. No, that's exactly right. That's where I was born, in Stocker Hospital in Oconomowoc, and I was. One very proud moment in my life is back when Edgar was published, I was able to come back and do a reading in Oconomowoc. So I felt like, you know, I'd swum all the way upstream to my place of origin to read this story. I didn't grow up in Oconomowoc, though. I should say that Oconomowoc is outside of Milwaukee. Shortly after I was born, I was maybe 2 years old, my folks decided they wanted to move from a more suburban, urban area to a remote farm. They wanted to raise their kids basically in the country. And so they did, in many ways, they did exactly what is happening in Familiares. They decided they were going to reset their life and go and live on a farm. And that was in central Wisconsin.
Well, your first work, and it, of course, overwhelming success, but it was in your mid-40s that you started this process. So how did that evolve?
Well, before Edgar was published, I'd had a long and very happy career in doing research in computer science. I didn't do a lot of theoretical computer science, which is heavy on mathematics and proofs and things like that. What I like to do is build experimental programs as proof of concept. One of the things that I learned in that process was just the high degree of craft and art of computer programming, which is not, people don't normally think, I think, of computer programming as an artistic endeavor, but it is building machines out of pure language. That's what you do when you're writing programs. And I'm not talking about like scripts for, you know, spreadsheets or something like that. I'm talking about writing programs from scratch in a high-level programming language. It was a fascinating thing to do. I still do it. I loved it. I loved the people I worked with, all of whom turned out to be far more creative than I would have imagined from the, I worked with people who were programmers, but dancers, programmers, but singers, programmers, but actors. So I feel like I learned about how to build things with language for 27 years.
Well, we're going to spend a few more minutes with this decorated writer, David Robluski, after this time out of 89.3 seconds on Talk Louisiana. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to Talk Louisiana, and we're talking with a fabulous writer, David Robluski. Now, writers come in many shapes and forms, as we know, and my favorite, Norman Mailer, he wrote and wrote and wrote, and when he wasn't writing books or writing fiction and nonfiction, he wrote letters, but he was a guy who just had to write. Now, Ernest Gaines, who wrote masterpieces, only wrote a few books, I think fewer than 10, but they're all classics. And David Robluski, you've got two classics, but they were 15, 16 years apart. So writing, obviously, for you is, it's something that you take a lot of pride in and a lot of precision. It's a big book, but from page to page, it captures our attention. Your thoughts about the process that you take. And I know you're married to a writer as well.
That's right. My partner is Kimberly McClintock. We met actually in a MFA program in North Carolina. And we share our materials. We are each other's first and last reader. But I'm slow. It just takes me a long time to write scenes. I have to overwrite them, massively overwrite them, until I know exactly what everyone is thinking, where everyone is standing, where the light is coming from, what it sounds like, whether it's hot, whether it's cold. And once I know all that, and I do that through my fingers, I have to just put it all down. Once I know all that, I essentially have to throw it all away and then say, okay, now what is the dramatic moment that's happening here? And then I draw from that material. But I am not, and I'm amazed at writers who can do otherwise. What I can't do is sit down and just say, this is the dramatic moment. This is exactly the bounds of the scene. This is the conflict that's going to play out, and do that succinctly and accurately and get the kind of details that I want in the story. I think that's the people who can do that, I think, are superhuman, but I'm not one of them.
Familiaris takes readers on an unforgettable journey from the halls of a small town Wisconsin automobile factory through an epic Midwestern firestorm, even an ambitious World War II dog training program, and far back into mankind's ancient past, examining dynamics of love and friendship. It's quite a book. And before we go, Jim on I-12, I know, has been waiting a while to talk with you. And Jim, we'll let you have the floor and have a moment or two with David Robluski. Hi, Jim.
Hi. I've got a couple of quick questions. When you're talking about that you're also a computer programmer, do you find that that has kind of invaded into your writing, and that you're writing programmatically, where you have all those if-then statements and do characters stuck in do loops, and as a programmer, do you also like heavily annotate your code, and kind of the way you just talked about the way that you do your scenes?
Thank you, Jim. David,
that's a really interesting question. Nothing about the details of programming or programming languages applies to writing fiction. However, the craft, the lessons of craft, my apprenticeship to the notion of craft and the amount of work it takes to build something out of language, that's what I've taken from the world of computer science and the level of precision with which they work. But I don't structure the scenes based on sort of the principles of programming. There are organizational principles in fiction, but they're entirely different than those in computer programming. So what I took away from that is just the discipline of working with language every day. I understand how long it takes to get something right, how many revisions it has to go through, and so on. So that's the main lesson that I've taken from it.
Well, thank you, David Robluski, and congratulations. You're an inspiring fellow. And I think people who feel like they have a hankering to write, they should follow the lead that you have been a pace setter in, and you did it at a time in life when most people would not give it a whirl, and look what's happened. Congratulations, my friend. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
And we're joined now in studio by Johnny Domino. Johnny has a website here in Baton Rouge that is very popular in some quarters and unknown in many others. It's called Ghetto Waze. That's Ghetto, W-A-Z-E. And it is Instagram and also, of course, conventional ways to retrieve information. And he, of course, is involved in many things going on in our community, including the mayor's race. Yesterday, we heard from Michael Baychok, who is with Sharon Weston Broom, and Johnny Domino is with Ted James. But before we get there, you're open about your past. You were, shall we say, a badass?
Yeah, Jim. Like I do recovery work now, so I help people get off of drugs, right? And the one thing you know about that is transparency helps you stay straight, stay right. So the more honest you are about your past and the things you've done, it's the best way to make your transformation. So I don't hide none of that. So nobody can use it against me because I got a site named Ghetto Ways. I come straight from the ghetto, but God is showing me another way, you know.
You are 42?
Yes, sir.
So born what, in 82?
81.
81, so you're about to be 43 then.
Yes, sir, in September, September 30th, Libra. Balance, justice.
I like that. One day before Jimmy Carter turns 100, Johnny Domino will be 43.
Come on now.
But Ghetto Ways, and you've been in jail, haven't you, a few times?
I've been a couple times, man. One of my most proud times of going to jail was when I was protesting, and then on a Showtime series called Your Honor that made it to Netflix, I had a scene in jail. That's after I changed my life, though, Jim.
So, first time, a listener who actually knows a little bit about you says that the Secret Service was on your trail. The Secret Service are usually involved in two things, either trying to assassinate a president or counterfeiting.
Right.
You weren't a Billy Cannon guy, were you?
No. I don't. Look, I want to preserve life. I don't want to shoot nobody. And look, I'm not trying to hit nobody's ear. No.
But were you involved in counterfeiting?
No. Well, I was allegedly involved, and that's what they were coming for. They were asking, and I was like, man, I thought y'all hang around the president. It was like, we come out for certain little things. We come on out. And I was like, man, yeah, I got picked up on that, and that's where Johnny Domino came from. That's what the pseudonym Johnny Domino.
So your real name's not Johnny Domino.
Oh no, my real name is Kylie Clifton.
I kind of like that one too.
Yeah.
But Johnny Domino kind of rolls off the tongue.
Yeah.
But you want to make this a better place, and you have changed your life. How'd you do it?
God, Jim. I can honestly say that when I changed, I wasn't ready. I was addicted to criminal activity. I was brainwashed, you know, by the same streets that brainwashed people in my areas. And my concern is always the poor people in the urban areas where I grew up in. I always want to pour back in because mentors like Kevin Franklin, who went to Catholic High and you know, led the way for Warwick Dunn, believed in me when I didn't believe in myself. I had a low thought and goal for myself. Mm-hmm. And God turned it around, man, because I always love people. I always love children, and I love old people. I love my seniors, man. Like, you got to take care of everybody on the way in this wicked world and on the way out. I mean, that's just what I believe. And then you got to sow the seeds. If you want people to look after your kids, or your grandmother, you got to treat them that way. But God was able to take me out, man. Something just came to me today, and it one day, and it was like, you're going to be destroyed, and you're going to be a man about it, and you're going to take your lick, whether it be jail or death, but are you ready for that? And you still got kids out there. And sometimes, I don't know, it just rang real hard, and it got me out the way, though. I heard it loud and clear.
You're not a graduate of GED, but went to Bel Air in Glen Oaks.
Yeah, GED stands for Good Enough Diploma.
Well, you're doing okay, but yeah. Listener asks, it's a legitimate question. Did you serve any time at Angola or another facility?
I didn't make it to Angola. I took some kids there to try to scam straight, but I was able to obtain counsel, do probation on some charges. The Secret Service charge was never billed. They never billed me on that, meaning they didn't have enough to move forward, or they decided not to go forward for some reason.
Well, we'll spend a few more minutes with Johnny Domino of Ghetto Ways, and then it's Mark Ballard on Talk Louisiana. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to Talk Louisiana, Robin Dow producing, and a few more minutes with Johnny Domino, and then it's Mark Ballard in the Beltway, which is, of course, the center of the political universe, and we are 89 days away from the November 5th election. And Johnny Domino is backing Ted James for mayor over Sharon Weston Broome. Why?
I'm backing Ted James over Sharon Weston Broome because I gave her 2 terms, 8 years. And me saying that she deserved 12 and he don't deserve 4 don't seem right in my mind. I was really hoping that she would pass that on to him. Mm-hmm. I like Ted. I know him better. I've seen his fights for the people. I've known people that he's helping people and the people that he's done things for. And he's hungry. I feel like he's hitting that ground real hard. He's out there touching the people. He's talking to a lot of people, and he's getting a lot of insights. And I just don't think it's fair to give one person 12 and then not be able to give another person equally, or in my opinion only. I'm going to just speak for me. I can't speak for the world, but I feel like he's more qualified. I think he's going to give us a different look with some of the similarities that she has. But I think he's more – they keep talking about division. But if Ted got every side supporting him, ain't that unity?
Well, we'll find out on Election Day. Now, Michael Baychak, who's a very good political consultant yesterday, and he's led her to victory twice, by the way. But yesterday he predicted there would likely be a runoff, but he thought it would be with a Republican, most likely Sid Edwards. But I personally, and I follow politics too, I think Edwards is going to have a hard time moving past Ted James into the number two slot. I think the most likely scenario is a runoff between Broome and James, which will be a race for the ages. And before we go, listener, good question. The website, by the way, is GhettoWaze, W-A-Z-E. Asked about Judge Ebony Johnson Rose being suspended by the high court. Does Ghetto Ways have a stance on that?
Just to be frank and honest with you, I feel like a majority of media takes care of the black community and the crime and the bad that we do. If it's bad for everyone, I may fool with it, but I think she's getting enough exposure on that, and I like to find the things that nobody want to talk about. I want to find the hidden things. I want to find the people who have power and pull to say, don't put my uncle on the radio or don't put my uncle on the news. That's who I want. I mean, when somebody else is doing a job, Ghettoways is to fill the void of the people that never get heard.
I love that. Yeah. I love that because there are a lot of stories that aren't being covered, but this is a big story. When a judge gets booted off the bench, I think you got to acknowledge that it's worth covering. The media aren't driving it. They didn't make the decision. They're just covering the news.
Yeah, and that's what I like about Ghettoways. I do what I want. I don't have a handler. You know, I don't have nobody. Like, I want the people who really, like, I feel like they've been beating up black judges lately enough. I don't think I should even throw a lick into that.
You know what I mean? Thank you, sir. Mm-hmm. And congrats on your reformed life and your success. Johnny Domino, hope to have you back.
Thanks for having me. I enjoy it.
What's the tattoo on the...
Oh, that's Nefertiti. Yeah, and that says, I need my lawyer means no snitching. But you see that tattoo's old. I still don't believe in snitching.
No, well, but if you don't tell on somebody who's committing a crime, then doesn't that mean that they're more likely to commit another crime?
Yeah, but I think that's civilian work and police work. I come from a different era, and when I give a man my word.
How do the police solve crimes without cooperation from people who are victims of crimes?
A civilian, they got to be civilians. See, I when you sign up to something,
when you say what do you call a
civilian? Is a person that lives by the police. I don't live by the police. I don't call the police for anything.
What do you do?
I can need an ambulance and a fire truck, and I donate to the firemen every year. I think they're real resourceful, and I love the EMTs and stuff like that. I just come from a different walk of life and had a lot of trouble with police, and I could protect myself.
Thank you, Johnny.
Thank you, Jim. Appreciate you, man.
All right. Met Johnny at Louie's the other day. You never know. You never know who's going to pop in at 7:30 in the morning at Louie's, but Johnny Domino did. Mark Ballard is now in Washington, D.C. I'm sure Mark's found a few eateries that he likes in that great city. There are a few, Mark.
There are quite a few. And there's a lot of diversity in the food here. I think the DMV tends to be a far more diverse place than what I'm used to in Louisiana.
Well, diversity is good.
Well, I found it good. At least, you know, I'm a foodie, and so I like, you know, trying different things of cuisines from people I've never heard of before. So it's been good. It's good at that. There's also a good number of Louisiana eateries up here as well, because a lot of our folks have moved into this area.
Well, you have adapted well. How long's it been?
I guess a couple of years. I was thinking that I got up here in September 2023, or was it 2022?
It had to be 2022. You've been there a little while, yeah. So coming up on 2 years. Now, yesterday, our friend Patrick in Ennis-Walda States, I hope he calls. I was commenting that the numbers are the numbers. That's why I love baseball, is because you can argue and argue about who's greater. And some players, of course, look better, or maybe you saw them on a good day, or maybe you're just carried away with rooting for a team. But we tend to have our faves, and some people like Donald Trump. But the fact is, America lost 2.7 million jobs during his 4 years in office, and 15 million jobs have been created during Joe Biden's 3.5 years. So on that, it's advantage Biden. But Patrick brought up a good point. He said Trump had to deal with COVID. Well, so did Biden. And I looked it up. More people died in 21 and 22 from COVID than they did in the year of 2020 when it began, by a pretty good margin. So COVID affected Joseph Robinette Biden too, and it's probably the big reason why we had this massive inflation for a while.
Well, yes, that certainly played into it, and at least that's what all the economists say. That, and then the war in the Ukraine, which disrupted, and then in Israel, which disrupted supply lines, that played into it as well. America has done a much better job at avoiding the deep recessions and economic problems that plagued much of Europe. So there's that.
Well, we talk about diversity, and we've got quite a foursome with Donald Trump and J.D. Vance and Kamala Harris and Tim Walz. It's quite a group of characters, the fearsome foursome. What's your take on the two tickets?
Well, in many ways, yeah, I mean, you're right, there is a diversity thing, but in many ways they're very similar type of tickets, in that rather than diversifying, that basically Trump chose a younger version of himself with J.D. Vance, and then Kamala Harris chose an older version of herself, so that they didn't really kind of make a step out in an attempt to kind of bring in others, that they're playing to their base for the most part.
Well, today in the New York Times, this one of many profiles on Tim Walz, it says Tim Walz never attended an Ivy League school. He never wrote a political memoir. He once worked at a tanning bed factory in Jonesboro, Arkansas. And until he was 40, he never showed much interest in a career in politics. Mr. Walz, the 60-year-old governor of Minnesota, chosen by Vice President Kamala Harris as a running mate, had not devoted his life to reaching the pinnacle. In selecting Mr. Walz, Ms. Harris has picked a one-man rejoinder to the idea that the Democrats are the party of the cultural and coastal elite. His biography and his style are a sharp contrast not only to Ms. Harris, who is from California, but also to former President Donald J. Trump, a New York billionaire, and to some degree to Mr. Trump's running mate, J.D. Vance, who graduated from Yale Law School and wrote a best-selling memoir. Walz has led a life that stands out in the top echelon of American politics, a tableau filled with scenes of farming, turkey hunting, weekends of National Guard duty, public schools, and coaching the local high school football team to a state championship. So he is a guy who they're trying to frame as a, quote, man of the people. Will it work, Mark Ballard?
Well, I mean, that's certainly what they're aiming for. But I'm speaking of politically, and politically that Walz falls under the politics that is embraced by the vice president, whereas Vance falls under the politics that's embraced by Trump. And yeah, there is a difference, and I think that what the Democrats were aiming for is to kind of reclaim sort of that rural and blue-collar people that they had cornered for years and years and years. Lately, though, I mean, really since President Obama and certainly under President Biden, that the Democratic Party had become more popular with highly educated and professionals, much more so than the Republicans, who are, you know, put off by Donald Trump and sort of this MAGA theory, this kind of politics by anger theory that's going on. And so I think that with Governor Walz, that there's an effort to kind of grab that Midwestern, middle class, rural type of voter that once was the mainstay of the Democratic Party.
A listener asked, this is Holly in the Garden District, will this play well in Louisiana? Well, it may play better than some other candidates, but I know Steve Wynum's going to not like me saying it, but I think Donald Trump's a safe bet to carry Louisiana, Mark.
I think, yeah, I don't see anything having changed as far as Louisiana goes. Though, you know, I imagine that you're right that the Walz will play better in Louisiana than, say, Josh Shapiro would have, you know, another Ivy League educated lawyer that lives on the coast, in a big city on the coast. So, I mean, I think that he plays better, but I don't think he's going to play well enough to change Louisiana's support.
877-217-5757 is your number. Mark Ballard's at the ready. We'll take some calls and hear from you after this. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to Talk Louisiana. 877-217-5757. Mark Ballard is at the ready, and you can send emails to talk@talklouisiana.org. The Dow Jones Industrial Average, which went down after Fred Dent's appearance yesterday, is now back up 528 points. So S&P's up 93. We'll see what happens, but it is a topsy-turvy world, and the economy, of course, is usually the driving force in an election, and as we noted, both candidates are trying to persuade voters that they're better than the other, and we've noted some things that are in favor of Joe Biden when you measure his performance, Biden-Harris against Trump and Pence, but the poverty rate did decrease by 1.3% during Trump's presidency. Economic growth was down 2.2%. But ironically, Trump saw some movement in the right direction with minority people who did better, although on the whole, not nearly as well as the white majority in America. But he said the other day, Mark, that he was the best president for black people since Abraham Lincoln. Was that a bit of hyperbole from the former president?
Well, I mean, you know, he's a politician. Anyway, they say, and politicians say lots of things that are not accurate, or not totally accurate. I mean, that's I think that you can always sit and say, well, he went, that what he was saying, you know, has some validity to it, but it's perhaps not the whole story.
Well, in politics, it used to be that the election was the bellwether, and if you got fewer votes or more votes, you either went home or you declared victory and served for whatever office. But now it's as though Ted Williams didn't hit 344. That's fake news. That's fake news. Well, sometimes it's harder to prove something is fake, and it's easy to say it's fake. And now fake news tends to be anything that's against what we want, Mark.
Well, this is true. I mean, our world, I guess, is basically turned into I have an opinion, and I only seek out those opinions that agree with me. And if it's not the same, then it becomes, an attack. And then that's why you keep hearing, on both sides, but saying, the mainstream media is at fault, for basically, reporting what is going on. But we're one of the institutions that are under attack in this kind of free world of social media, where everybody can say anything and you can find somebody to agree with you.
Well, I noted a few times on this show when Biden was running and now with Harris, that if Democrats desire to win, and of course they do, they've got to do it in the Electoral College. And right now in the Real Clear Politics, the three states that Democrats most likely will have to win, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, and Michigan. Harris is ahead by 0.5 in Wisconsin and 2 points in Michigan. She's down by 1.8 in Pennsylvania. So why didn't she choose Josh Shapiro as her running mate?
I don't know quite. She hasn't told me why she didn't do it, but it appears that that they made the calculation of that Shapiro would have been another elite lawyer that lived on the coast, in a big city on the coast, and that there's also the other thing, apparently, that she got along better with the governor from Minnesota than she did with Shapiro. And so they also made the choice of basically Bernie Sanders and the progressive wing, said that if you need to keep the progressive wing, you're going to need to have someone who believes in progressive views, and that was Governor Walz. And so, I mean, those were the issues, at least that's been widely reported, that they came up when she made that selection. But I think the biggest one, I mean, keep in mind that, that this is going to be your lunch partner at least once a week for the next 4 years. You have to be able to get along with them.
Yep. Patrick in Innisfail States. Hello, Patrick. You're on with Mark Ballard.
Hey, I think she made a big mistake picking this VP guy. And we're talking about personal attacks. He got up there and said weird as hell about Donald Trump and Vance. But then the more you look into this guy, you realize he's really weird. I mean, putting tampons in boy locker rooms. His wife liked the smell of tires during the riots. You know, she had the windows open.
All right. You're veering off on stuff that I'm sure is
Well,
not verified, but Patrick, I think his background shows he's anything but weird. He's a pretty regular guy. That's one of the reasons why he was chosen.
Make him look like a regular guy.
Well, he was a coach of a championship high school team. All right. Well, Patrick, you're obviously using some talking points, smelling tires and putting tampons in locker rooms. Okay. All right. Okay.
They're calling them Tampon Tim now.
Well, I'm sure they are. But
no, the Republicans call them Tampon Tim because that's part of their way of trying to denigrate the guy. And that's what you're doing, is trying to denigrate the guy without actually having any information about where you could attack him on, and which would be his policy positions. He has a very progressive policy positions and passed very progressive policies in Minnesota. And if you were going to have an argument about policies, which I think is legitimate, that's one thing. If you're going to start calling them names, that's another thing. And I think that's, one of the downfalls of our politics right now is that we go directly to calling folks names.
Well, here's a story from NPR. Republican critics of Democratic vice presidential candidate Tim Walz have given him a new nickname, Tampon Tim, after Vice President Harris announced her pick. Stephen Miller, a former advisor to former President Trump, tweeted she actually chose Tampon Tim. And this is actually a moniker that the Democrats are embracing because they consider it so ridiculous. It refers to a law that Walz, when he was governor of Minnesota, as he is right now, signed last year, requiring public schools to provide menstrual products to students in 4th through 10th grades. Now, give me a break, Patrick. Give me a break. You're calling him Tampon Tim? What do you call Donald Trump, who slept with Stormy Daniels, who was found liable for sexually assaulting a woman in a department store and has had 5 children with 3 different wives? Mark?
Well, I think that's clear. And why was it that after George Santos was indicted, that they kicked him out of the House, yet after Donald Trump was convicted, they said nothing about it? And why is it that we attack Kamala Harris for not sitting on the podium for Benjamin Netanyahu's speech, yet let J.D. Vance slide because he wasn't there either? I mean, this is politics, and this is a presidential year. That's, if we're going to get reasoned intellectual debate about policies and what's the best route forward on America, then you certainly can't do it during an election, sadly.
But when they caught Michael Dukakis in a tank and the optics were really, really bad, that was fair game. That's okay. But Tampon Tim, come on. You can do better than that. James in Metairie. James, good morning.
Good morning, Jim. Good morning, Mark. J.D. Vance's vicious, bigot attacks on childless American females who have cats. Well, Kevin Roberts is doing, the guy who runs the Heritage Foundation from Louisiana, by the way. He is attacking the proliferation of dog parks. Mark, is this good politics to attack Americans who own and love their cats and dogs?
I bet you went to the Raising Cane's dog park a few times when you lived in the Garden District, Mark.
From time to time we did go. Yep. We did take our dog to the, I guess this is what has turned into my theme today, which is that it is an election year and we tend to basically attack one another rather than talk about policies.
Well, in the election, quite likely will be very close, and
it's going to be very, very close.
And it likely will be contested if it goes one way, and maybe either way. But Al Gore certainly contested his election, maybe he had a case, but he lost and he went away. Remember, he said, "It's time for me to go." He didn't say, "Go down there and show them you're mad as hell." Well, is that what we're headed for again? Are we headed for what same thing we had in 2021, Mark?
I think so. And perhaps it might even be worse because you basically went in 2020 that the election was always, very close and up in the air. But here, I mean, we've just gone. And I can tell you from the number of hours I've worked in this in the month of July, but we've just gone from one side to the other. I mean, it's just been politics has flip-flopped all around. And so it depends on what you where you land when the election is over, should it, all the enthusiasm that the vice president has created since Biden stepped aside, or, the number of Republicans who would, they'll walk on heated lead after he got shot, And so, I mean, it's if we land on those particular moments, I can't see how the other side won.
Well, thank you, Mark Ballard. Let's talk again next week. Always an honor and pleasure. And great to talk with Johnny Domino, too. Back tomorrow. Stay safe. Stay tuned.